We present the News Quiz with your host, Miles Jupp.
Hello! And welcome to the News Quiz. We start with a cutting from the Oxford Mail, read by Diana Speed.
The medieval bridge in Newbridge will have its own camera system installed to protect it from overweight lorry drivers.
Our thanks to Diana Green for sending that in. Now, let's meet the teams. Will you welcome first on my right, Jeremy Hardy and Desiree Birch. And opposite them on my left, Hugo Rifkin and Susie Ruffle. Hugo, why has no deal just got real?
So we're still trying to negotiate Brexit. The UK has its negotiation position, led by David Davis, the famous genius. And the EU has a position that is formulated and controlled by Michel Barnier, because he's worth it. That's a great joke, and no one ever laughs at it. Love that joke. It's my favourite joke ever. The idea, anyway, is that they've got to come to a deal with the EU, but there is now the growing prospect that they might not come to a deal. They might come to no deal. And Theresa May always used to say that no deal was better than a bad deal, which never made any sense, because, like, if it's a bad deal, then all deals are better than it, unless they're a worse deal. So who knows what was happening in her malfunctioning cyborg brain with that one. But now there is a real chance we leave the EU with no deal. We just sort of crash out of it onto sort of World Trade Organization rules. But even leaving with no deal means you need some preparation. So there's now a suggestion that we should have, like, a deal for no deal. Like a no-deal deal. Or if we don't, then at least we have to agree not to have an agreement about not having an agreement, which would be a sort of no-deal, no-deal deal, or perhaps a deal, no-deal deal, which sounds pretty bad to me, but loads of Tories are saying, look, it's not a big deal, let's just go with that and let's do it. And now Amber Rudd has come out and said, absolutely not, we must have a deal, no deal would be a disaster, whereas Liam Fox has said no deal would be fine. So basically what the public now has to decide is whether they trust Amber Rudd over Liam Fox or whether they're idiots.
Do you think we'll be asked at some point what we think?
What, you and me?
I mean...
Again, do I think there'll be another referendum?
Yeah.
No.
I think the question of whether or not we have a referendum should be up to the public to decide.
But we're told if we don't get behind this that we're being sort of unpatriotic and we basically wanted Germany to win the war. So let's be a bit more. Come on now. What, Susie, what's good about a no deal? There we are. I couldn't have put it better.
It's never a good thing, isn't it? You never get back from a shopping trip and someone goes, oh, how was it? You go, it was absolutely brilliant. I didn't get one deal. It's never, and they keep using the phrase crashed out. I don't think crashed out can ever... Can't be in a positive light, can it? Like, drunk Susie crashed out of a fire escape, keeping all of her dignity intact. It just doesn't sound... It doesn't sound positive. I'm going to put my head above the parapet. I'm going to be the first person to say this. I'm not sure Brexit was a good idea.
Why do young people hate this country?
There can't be no deal. If there's no deal, then, like, you know, aeroplanes can't fly anymore because it's only the European Union that keeps them in the air and things like that. This is true. I'm not just making it up on the radio.
Oh, yeah, so the fallout of lots of different regulatory bodies will not be regulated by anything.
It's interesting that Amber Rudd has sort of stepped up, hasn't she? It's a bit like the way she did the leaders' debate on telly during the election. She's now minister for all the stuff that Theresa May can't handle, isn't she? She just is like the one who just steps in and says, I'll handle this.
She was the one who's like, no deal is unthinkable. But, like, didn't she have, like, 5 recounts during the general election?
Oh, she
you
did,
know, she
yeah.
will not take no for
yeah,
an answer.
No, she's no idea. No, she's no fool. She carried on until the tellers said, oh, all right, then you can be MP.
This is the news that the Prime Minister was this week urged to prepare for a no-deal Brexit. Apparently, Westminster insiders are increasingly talking of a bare-bones deal, which has been dubbed No Deal Plus, replacing the former terms Catastrophe Extra and Misery Deluxe Edition. The World Bank estimates UK trade with the EU in goods could fall by 50% if no trade deal is agreed. But do we really need trade? I mean, you think you like oranges, but roll a potato in what's it dust? You're halfway there. To Theresa May posted a letter on Facebook, there's Martin, addressed to the 3 million EU citizens living in the UK today, assuring them that they are welcome in this country. See, it's Facebook for the nice messages, Vans for the aggressive, unfriendly ones. Liam Fox said that leaving without a deal would not be the Armageddon that people project. That's a phrase that fills you with confidence, doesn't it? Dear Susan and Steve, have a wonderful wedding. I'm sure it won't be the Armageddon that people project. Two points to Hugo. Desiree, who appears to know sweet F.A. about discrimination?
So this is the Football Association. There was a recent parliamentary inquiry into accusations of systemic racism within the FA. The funny thing about this is that like this started years ago because the FA were trying to do this sort of like, oh, we're going to do this sort of anonymous poll amongst people involved in the FA and see how they feel like the culture's doing. And so they anonymously asked Annie Aluko to like give them some feedback on like how they were doing on race. And she was like, there were a couple of things, like the goalkeeping coach kept talking to me in like a patois or something. Like he kept using a Caribbean accent and I kicked the ball and he'd be like, Everton Irie, and it'd be weird. He'd be like, no woman, no cry. And she's like, it'd still be weird because like I'm Nigerian. So that's like it's arguable whether it would have been less or more racist if he had just like grabbed some of the pitch, ran it over her forehead and went, Azabenga! Would have at least been continentally accurate. The accusations, and all of these are still accusations, but it was like they hired a black actor to come in and demonstrate what not to do as lioness behavior. And all of the other teammates were like, whoa. Like, you know it's bad racism when white people are like, whoa! Like, why does the actress have a spear? That doesn't even make sense. Racist, right? And so they paid her money. They paid her money to be like, we don't want this to be a problem. We're not racist, but like, here's some cash, right? But they only gave her half the cash. And then they were like, we'll give you the other half if you say we're not racist. So yeah, that's what happened today in racism.
I used to think of racism was on the terraces, and then we realised it was on the pitch. But gradually it's making its way right up to the top of the organisation, which is good to know, isn't it? You know, racism's got a much higher status than it once had. It just used to be idiotic people throwing bananas on the pitch, and now it's quite powerful and informed people being bigots.
Now they have sort of workshops about it, don't they, and sort of team-building exercises.
Yeah.
How do we race this more effectively in a corporate environment?
When they said they were going to give... show them lioness standards. I was hoping they'd go like full lioness and someone would just like rip his face off. Just like go crazy. But like as a white person, I can say to all the other white people, and I imagine there'll be one or two listening to Radio 4 on the wireless. There's never been a situation where a white person has done a Caribbean accent and it's come off well. That was a great gag. Do that voice again. Like never. It just never happens.
Do you remember when Mike Reed... Yes. Did a song in a Caribbean accent.
Oh, for UKIP?
For UKIP, to show that UKIP wasn't racist. I sort of think I must have dreamt that, but it did happen, didn't it? But it's just football. I mean, there's basically one story in football beyond the sport, and that is, oh, my God, these people are awful. You know, and it's over and over again. It's like the worst thing that you can imagine happening just happens in football.
It's only in the spotlight because our hope now is entirely in our women's team, isn't it, in England? Because people used to say, well, the trouble with women, I can't see, so they can't act it, really, because the thing is, they all periods all synchronised, don't they? Trouble, and if one of them feels a call of nature, they all go out together, and then, like, it's a penalty kick, and they all start dancing around a handbag, it all goes tits up, doesn't it? So, whereas now, people realise women are quite good at working together because women are not as internally competitive as men. Whereas England players play like a bunch of men who've never met before, fighting in a pub car park amongst themselves.
This is the staggering and wholly unexpected news that the game of association football is run by absolutely appalling people. The FA finally apologised to players Ennio Luco and Drew Spence for racial discrimination before a remarkable hearing in front of the DCMS Select Committee, during which the FA was represented by, and I'm being as charitable as I can here, a four-person arsewit carnival. It was admitted that Aluko had been offered an out-of-court settlement for £80,000, £40,000 of which was then withheld unless she made a public statement saying the FA was not institutionally racist. The FA apparently are an organisation whose motto is, well, this seems fine. Still, at least, we know the glass ceiling has been broken now, that the England women's team is as riddled with racial discrimination as its male equivalent. What a year. First Jane Austen on the tenor, now this. 2 points to Desiree. Jeremy, who's trying to take credit?
Well, this is universal credit. And originally, this was the brainchild of Ian Duncan Smith. It's called brainchild because it's like a brain, but smaller and not as well developed. And that's what Ian Duncan Smith has got. And when he was Secretary of State for Workhouses and Penury, devised this idea because he was worried about the poverty trap, and George Osborne, who was then Chancellor, said, well, I know traps are cruel, but how else do I keep the poor off my land? And then Cameron said, well, dogs would be more humane because it would be quicker, but the townies are terribly sentimental about the poor, you see, but that's because they've never seen the carnage that the poor leave behind them in a chicken cottage. And people don't understand the poor are pets, they're just rats with scratch cards. People used to be poor in six ways, but they've rolled it into one benefit that you can't live on, because they said it should never be in a circumstance where you're better off not going to work. So they've made it impossible for people to heat their homes. So at least they'll always be warmer if they go into work. It never occurred to them that they could actually make wages higher to make sure that you're always better off working. They just thought, well, we'll just make people so poor that they have no choice. They did pilot it, which always suggests it's not a very good idea. When the Attlee government brought in the NHS and the welfare state, they thought, this is so good, let's just do it to the whole country at once. They didn't think, well, we'll try it in Oldham, and if no one dies, we'll go ahead. But they've decided that right before Christmas, they'll roll the plan out further, despite the fact that you don't get any money for 6 weeks. I suppose the idea is that during that 6 weeks, you learn your lesson, you think about what you've done, and you realise it's high time you inherited some money from somebody. And the one thing they've said they'll do is they'll make the phone line free, so that you can listen to Vivaldi's Four Seasons for hours on end without paying.
That's right, because it was, what, it was 55 pence a minute from some mobiles, wasn't it, to get help. What have Labour been up to in response to this?
Oh, they've kind of... I don't have a clue. No. they've voted it down, right? They passed a motion against it, and they opposed the phone thing particularly. They sort of pressured the government into scrapping the 55p phone bill. Because, I mean, it was only from mobiles, and you could tell it's this sort of typical Tory thing where it hadn't occurred to them there might be people who only have mobiles. Like, it's completely free if you send your butler.
They said it was a symbolic victory for Labour. Had quite a lot of symbolic victories of late, haven't they? It'd be great if they could have an actual victory. That'd be really good.
It's a shame, universal credit, because it's essentially a good idea. You know, it's the idea that benefits are far too complicated and you want to make a system so simple that an idiot can understand it. Unfortunately, what happened there was they announced this as the plan, and Ian Duncan Smith came along and said, I'm an idiot. And they said, great. You sort it out then. And he sort of has. And it doesn't quite seem to be working so well.
Have you been following this, Desiree?
Well, I've been basically learning about this a little bit. I mean, basically, it's, you know, it's simplifying by, like, cramming it into, like, one system, which, you know, I had to be explained to me just now because I was like, universal credit. That sounds like what Theresa May wants to take for all of Labour's ideas. But the thing that I read that seemed particularly messed up is that essentially, you know, it does take the 6 weeks for them to pay you in arrears, but they are willing to give you a loan of up to 50% of what they owe you in advance that you then owe them.
It's a bit like if AA, if you went to AA and you said, well, I'm doing a bottle of vodka a day, and they just said, have you thought about cider? Tories don't seem to understand is that this is all about money, because they sort of say, well, the important thing about poverty is getting people into work. And you say, yeah, but a lot of poor people are in work. Well, that, yes, exactly, because poor people need to be in work. Yeah, a lot of poor people are in work. Yes, when it's not actually work that makes the difference to poverty. I mean, none of us here do any work at all, and yet we're all doing fine. It's nothing to do with whether you've not got a job. It's how much money you've got. But the Tories just seem completely unable to grasp that vital connection between poverty and not having any money.
It's a form of sorcery. It really is. This is the ongoing row over the introduction of universal credit. With this week's Commons vote, Labour scored a big symbolic victory, which is a massive coup for all the symbolic benefit claimants out there, and indeed paves the way for Corbyn to become the country's first entirely symbolic Prime Minister. Universal credit works by combining six regular payments into one easy-to-understand administrative holocaust. The Conservatives denied that the six-week wait for universal credit showed they were out of touch, saying that claimants could do what everyone else does when money gets tight and simply sell a painting. Labour also managed to get the government to abolish charges of up to 55 pence a minute for the universal credit helpline, which was a bit much considering the first 10 minutes of just Secretary of State for Work and Pensions David Gawk whispering promises that he will chat you all the way to climax. 2 points. 2 points to Jeremy. And at the end of round one, the scores are Jeremy and Desiree have 4, and so too do Hugo and Susie. We start round two with an excerpt from the Donegal Daily.
There have been numerous complaints received in recent months from the owners of holiday homes around the county. One resident, who asked to remain anonymous, is called Tom McKeldroon. He's angry about construction near his home.
Thanks to Shane Roberts for sending us that. Susie, what put the wind up us this week?
The sky went weird. That's what happened, Miles. The sky went weird, got a bit pink, everyone lost their minds. That's what happened. And a particularly bizarre phenomenon was Cleveleys in Lancashire, where the storm whipped the sea into such a crazy frenzy that it covered the entire town in foam. So it basically looked like everyone in the town had inadvertently gone on an 18 to 30s holiday. Apparently it absolutely went off in Lidl. And it was a great day for social media, firstly because people were going crazy posting pictures of the sky, but secondly because it coincided on the same day as the Me Too hashtag, which was a hashtag about sort of all society's sort of misogyny that's going on. And so what happened was all of my timelines on Twitter, on Facebook, all the women were saying, like, girls, we need to stand together for womankind, and, like, we've all got each other's backs, don't worry. And then all of the men just going, shh, look at the sky, it's red.
Worried by this word storm of failure. It just sounds like some horrid, morbid, perverse obsession with weather, doesn't it?
I saw the headline, Ophelia rips the roof off a school, and I thought, God, I've been to some sick form productions of Hamlet. I mean, it sounds like an absolute humdinger.
I just kept wondering throughout the day how the Met Office would actually report the apocalypse, you know, if it really was the apocalypse. People are saying there's a beast coming out of the sea. Don't worry, there isn't.
Well, they'd have sort of graphics for that now, wouldn't they? They could generate... In the old days, when they had the magnets that they'd have to put up, and they'd be like, someone needs to go and get the monster magnet out.
They speak in made-up language, don't they, Mitchell? They say a few spits and spots of rain. Nobody does that apart from weather people, do they? I met one of them. They're tiny. They're no bigger than your thumb. They look quite big on the telly, but in real life, they're really small.
Like you?
Yeah. Yeah. I recognise it in other... It's like gaydar, but with small people. You kind of intuitively get a feeling, oh, he's one. Yeah.
I thought it was interesting. The Met Office issuing a yellow weather warning when the weather was actually yellow. You think, that's why they've got the system.
I once spent 2 days at the Met Office for a feature. They're really interesting people, but only about weather. There was once a little earthquake in Britain, and their phones rang off the hook with people going, how come you didn't predict the earthquake? And they were just going, like, earthquakes aren't weather. And they were asking around the office going, guys, are earthquakes weather? He goes, no, I'm pretty sure they're not.
This is the chaos caused by Hurricane Ophelia, which spread a trail of devastation across Ireland, Scotland and the west of the UK. Here in London, the sky was full of Saharan dust and ash from Portuguese forest fires, which took hours to disperse before allowing the blessed return of illegal levels of diesel fumes and sulphur dioxide. One paper reported rare phenomena, including a red sun and birds swirling mysteriously in the sky. Typical birds pissing about when things get serious. Large numbers of Portuguese man-o-war jellyfish were swept onto British and Irish beaches. If you get stung by one of these, the best thing to do is urinate on the affected area, and once you've had your fun, do something about the sting. Hurricane Ophelia coincided with the 30th anniversary of the Great Storm of 1987. However, this time, Michael Fish did predict it, lashing himself to Galway's harbour wall and shouting, "I'm ready for you this time, my salty mistress." Two points to Susie. Desiree, who's proud of making tough calls?
Trump did another Trump this week. Surprise, surprise. So basically 12 or 13 days ago, there was some military action in Niger. There were some American soldiers killed. Trump just called the families, like, I don't know, 5-10 minutes ago or whatever, to basically say, you know, like, sorry. But as he did it, he was like, well, your husband did know what he was signing up for. And it's just so appalling. And then he went and threw dust in everyone's faces by being like, none of the other presidents did any phone calling, which is like, I mean, technically not a complete lie, because at least the first 18 presidents didn't have phones. Right? So he's like, oh, fact, right? You know, but like, there's various ways in which they can contact the families.
In Trump's defense, it takes him about 12 days to write a letter.
It's just exhausting, though, Trump. I mean, you wake up and look at the news, you're like, he did what while I was asleep? All right, fine. And it's just not striking or interesting. It's just this weird state of affairs you've come to accept. Trump is president. It's like if Gaza was Pope, or, you know, Peter Andre is in charge of the World Bank. It's just what happens. You lose all kind of shock and surprise and almost interest in the terrible load of crap that happens. And because of that, you end up basically believing anything, right? So this week's big theory, I don't know if you've seen this, is that there is a Melania Trump impersonator, because she's actually left him. Because he did an interview the other day, and he said, my wife Melania, who is standing next to me right now, and carried on talk, which is a really weird thing to say when you're on camera, right next to her. But then you look at her, and she's a bit shorter than normal, and she's got a slightly wrong nose, and she's wearing, like, massive sunglasses.
She looked like Michael Jackson.
She always looks like Michael Jackson. But there is this big online theory that there is a fake Melania Trump. And if it was any other politician, since the dawn of time, you'd be like, no, don't be ridiculous. Whereas now you're kind of like, yeah.
It would be tempting to feel sorry for Melania Trump, but she really did know what she was signing up for.
That wasn't the only worrying news to come out of the White House this week. There was the thing with Mike Pence. They were in, like, a board meeting. They were talking about abortion rights and different things like that, and then LGBTQ stuff came up, and Trump pointed at Mike Pence, the VP, and said, don't ask that guy, he wants to hang them all. Oh, OK, you all didn't know that, OK. Mike Pence is so unbelievably homophobic that he has to be gay. Now, anyone that's gay in the room or listening at home will know this, that there is a brief moment as a gay person when you're, like, a bit homophobic. Like, I remember it happening to me when I was, like, 14, being like, oh, gays, women, blah, God, I would hate to put my hands all over her delicious body. What happened after that is that Mike Pence and then the Texan Senator Ted Cruz, there's, like, a pastor... Do I say pastor or pastor?
Depends what you're talking about.
So there's this guy that's, like, an American vicar, and... blamed Hurricane Harvey on Houston electing a lesbian mayor. Like, he said, well, it's the gays that's causing all the storms. And the thing is, like, it is us. That's the thing. And that is why, if any of you are interested, after a big hurricane or a big storm, there's always a massive rainbow. That's us.
This is the latest from self-proclaimed world's humblest man, Donald Trump. Not content with boasting about the size of his election win, the number of laws he's passed, the foreign policy successes he's engineered, this week he reached a nauseating new high by proudly bragging that he is the best at informing people about the deaths of their own relatives. Well done, Donald. I imagine people just instantly forget their grief and can talk of nothing else but your bedside manner. How like Florence Nightingale, and how unlike a complete psychopath. Also this week, Trump's third attempt at a travel ban was thrown out by a Hawaiian judge. Exactly like a regular judge, except the wig is topped with ham and tangy pineapple. Meanwhile, Rex Tillerson, winner of America's Name That Sounds Most Like a Closeted Film Star from the 1950s Award, responded to claims that Trump had castrated him, saying, "I've checked, I'm fully intact." Still, he did have to check, so clearly he thinks it's something of a fluid situation. 2 points to Desiree. Before we reveal the final scores, has anybody got a cutting they'd like to share?
Ben Webster and many others sent in this excerpt from the BBC News website. Passengers forced open the doors on a busy rush hour train and climbed onto tracks after becoming panicked in the carriage when a man began loudly reading passages from the Bible. Rail power lines were cut as passengers self-evacuated.
Desiree.
Yes. Tony Woodall in Buxton writes, "I'm an avid news quiz listener and wondered if this internal email I received from a German colleague would be suitable to be read out on the show. It certainly made me laugh. Subject, French expansion. I look forward to your views on the above subject. Many thanks in advance."
Hugo.
This is sent in by Benjamin Bird, and it's from the Daily Mail's website. And it says, "A dog walker and her basset hound Molly found an intact penis and testicles washed up on the beach at Breen, North Somerset. One resident nearby said the news was awful, while another added that it was not a massive shock."
Susie.
Ian Braun says his daughter Elizabeth spotted this in a leaflet for our local Lib Dem council candidate. "One of our latest victories was in West Yorkshire, where we gained a seat from the Tories on a massive swing."
Thank you, and now let's take a look at the final score. Jeremy and Desiree have 8, but this week's winners are Hugo and Susie with 9. Before we leave you, here's an excerpt from Countryfile magazine on the 2017 Young Farmer Award, sent in by Andrew Lau.
"Tom's passion for farming was triggered as a teenager when he would tag along with a local farmer and do the horses."
And with that, goodbye.
Taking part in the news quiz were Jeremy Hardy, Desiree Birch, Hugo Rifkind and Susie Ruffin. In the chair was Miles Jupp, and the news is read by me, Diana Speed. The chair script was written by James Kettle, Sarah Morgan and Benjamin Partridge, with additional material by Daniel Hooper and Jenny Laville. The producer was Joe Nunnery, and it was a BBC Studios production.